Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Do you need some inspiration in your life? Then my next guest is exactly what you're looking for. Jess Drewy started her wine brand Winey Baby at the tender age of 22. And since then, what hasn't she done? She's done everything differently, pretty much, from winning $250,000 on a Gordon Ramsay reality television show to getting distribution into 27 states. More importantly, she's connected with the coveted Gen Z category. And in this interview, she explains how she does it, from building a community on social media to being disciplined about her strategy. I learned a lot, and I hope you will too. For more information, don't forget to sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter at drinksinsider.com. And if you have any requests or suggestions for guests, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. I'm always happy to help. Hi, Jess. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited. We've got so much to talk about. So I'm going to start right at the beginning. You used to work for Red Bull, the energy drink. Yes. So how did you go from Red Bull and no wine industry experience to creating this fantastic label that everybody's talking about?
Well, I'm really terrible and I'm actually drinking a Celsius right now, our competitor.
And is it good?
It is. It's probably terrible for you. But, you know, as a young business owner, anything to get you going through the day. But it's actually funny. One of the many things that Red Bull taught me was brand loyalty. And I mean, you could not wear lime green, which is the colors of Monster, our competitor, in the office. You'd be like shamed. So they are like brand loyalists through and through. They taught me that, you know, you respect the can, you always, you know, have the product facing a certain way.
Hey.
And, you know, no one was to ever on camera. You can't pour it, you know, sometimes an athlete would jokingly pour it out or, you know, something funny. Absolutely not. So, I worked for Red Bull Media House, so not on the sales or really the product side at all. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was getting a world-class, you know, education from, in my opinion, the greatest beverage marketers of our generation. And they really taught me that, I mean, because I was on the media side, right? I was working with all the athletes and the artists and the dancers and the teams that make these incredible Red Bull documentaries, Red Bull TV and things that have gone on to win Emmys, all from an energy drink, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't know it at the time, but what it was showing me was a product, a beverage, can go far and beyond the product itself and really create a lifestyle, and a lifestyle that's resonated with all different kinds of people. And I've taken that with me and am on a mission to get the wine industry to take just a little bit of notes.
Right. Well, everybody wants to hear about this because yes. What you've done is what everybody else wants to do. So I'll just go back to Red Bull for a second. So what you're really talking about is incredible brand discipline. Is that something that you bring to Winey Baby?
I would say that I'm a little bit, I have a more fun approach, right? I'm a little bit, you know, more tongue in cheek. But what I absolutely have done is been disciplined in the fact that we are a lifestyle brand. We represent a lifestyle, and the lifestyle that we represent is people who value community and connection, which I think is everyone right now. Everybody's hungry for it. And wine is the greatest connector out there. It invites us to put our phones down and to, you know, meet with other people. And I was talking about this with someone the other day. You know, there's all this talk about young people don't drink. And what I try to be really disciplined in is, you know, not just taking notes from my little bubble, right? And saying, okay, there's a whole other, you know, nation and world out there that just because my friends all drink, that may not be true. But, you know, I go into, you know, restaurants and, you know, I try to be an active consumer myself and go to events and meet up with other Gen Zers. And they do drink. They may be drinking differently than in the past, but they do drink. And where I think that the industry can be really optimistic is the way that wine invites us to drink slowly and savor and not, you know, tequila shots partying till 2 a.m. What I'm really seeing is a shift in that style of drinking.
Let's go back a step, because you didn't have a wine background. You started from zero. So tell the story about what made you decide to launch a wine brand.
So I was 22 working at Red Bull. I was a college dropout, so I was fortunate to get a couple more of like corporate years under my belt than a normal 22-year-old might have. But I always say you either grew up in a household where your parents would have a glass of wine at dinner or, you know, they didn't. And I grew up where they didn't. And so if you didn't grow up in a family that was naturally around you, where does your wine education come from? It doesn't. And we have an industry that just expects people to figure it out, right? You walk into a grocery store at 22 years old and you go, I have no clue where to begin. And so I found myself in that exact situation. I had a first date with a guy. It was, you know, the first time I was really able to focus on my personal life because my, you know, Red Bull was remote. Every company was remote at that time. Restaurants weren't open. And so I was like, okay, I should probably start, you know, having a dating life. And he said, why don't you come over? I'll cook for you. You bring a bottle of wine. And I walked into a Whole Foods and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I had the experience that I think a lot of people, whether you're a Gen Z or you're 22 or you're 42 and just have never dipped your toes into wine, you can have a shared experience of looking at the wine aisle and going, I have no clue what to grab for this occasion. I have no clue what a varietal is, or really just where to begin in wine. And that's
I read that you started Googling how to put a wine brand together. Was that a point in your life where you were thinking, I want to be a business owner? What, you know, that's such a huge thing to go and do.
I think that my greatest superpowers are naivety and enthusiasm. If I knew what I knew now, I probably wouldn't have done it, thankfully, because obviously it is a very tough industry. But yeah, you can Google anything now and just figure it out as you go. There was not a lot of resources out there, but what there was where you could buy bulk wine and how you could get a alcohol license that would allow you to ship direct to consumer in California. And that's what I did. I got a Type 86 license. I found a place that I could bulk purchase some wine. I couldn't do shiners because I had all these special things I wanted to do to the bottle. One thing I'm really, really passionate that people take away from Winey Baby is it's not just a trendy label. Any of these big companies can make a trendy label. Cool. It really is a reimagined experience through and through.
Yeah, talk me through that, because you've got everything. You've got stickers, you've got conversation starters. I mean, you really have reimagined it all. So was this stuff that you came to gradually, or did you know right from the start, this is going to be how I'm going to run it?
Yeah, so, you know, never grew up as the type of person who was like, I'm meant to be an entrepreneur. I'm a hard worker. I've always worked. I've loved working. But I like to say you're probably an entrepreneur if in every job you have, you're wanting to do everyone else's job. And I go, oh, maybe I'd like this department. You know, I loved everything. And that's what an entrepreneur, you know, does a little. They do everything. And so I definitely didn't set out, but it just came authentically. I walked out of the store that day, went, there's a need here.
So were you a kid that put stickers everywhere?
I was a kid who was constantly saying, I'm bored, I'm bored, I'm bored. You know.
So when you got the bulk wine, in terms of the taste, what did you do? Did you just go, that's the right price, you know, I'll stick it in the bottle? Like, what was that process like?
I had no clue what I was doing. And it for people who know wine, it shows. Thankfully, my target consumer doesn't know wine, so they didn't know. And they thought, wow, this is amazing. I literally Googled the top purchased wines. And what came up was a cab and a shard. Little did I know that's not really what Gen Z drinks, but I didn't know. I was just figuring it out as I went. So that's literally what I did. The wine itself was good. It was fine. It did the job. And I sold those bottles. I'm trying to remember now. I think I sold them online for.
So what happened? You get the wine, you get the labels and everything. Did it get delivered to your house and you had to post it out? I mean, how did you actually sell it?
So I have no shame. I will reach out to anyone and everyone. And actually, I have been pleasantly surprised on my wine industry journey that people have been lovely and welcoming and very helpful. And I worked with kind of a wine broker.
You know why? Because everyone was so excited to see a young person. I bet they pounced on you. They went, yes, I'm opening the door. Come in and bring some friends.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually, unfortunately, but fortunately for me at the time, there was plenty of bulk wine that people wanted to, you know,
and
sell.
There's even more now. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So I worked with this wine broker and he was kind of like, oh, the quantities you're doing are not at the level, obviously, at the time that they were doing. And he basically just connected me to this winery that sold me the wine and allowed and stored it for me and had a mobile bottling, company that came and bottled them. So they stored it. Made labels with a company that had never made wine labels. So if you look at my original bottles, they look completely different and they're similar, but there's, so many imperfections, you know, bubbles and it wasn't the right size and all sorts of things like that. But again, naivety, it wasn't perfect. It did the job. And they stored it for me. We bottled it. And then, I worked with kind of a legal consultant that made sure I, you know, dotted my I's and crossed my T's, where I got the Type 86 license. And then I stored it at a facility that, you know, legally, you know, was temperature controlled and all that. And then I would get my orders, go to the facility, bring them back to my mom's house. We'd box them up and ship them out ourselves. And I think
you were exploiting your mum to start with. Did you pay her?
I one day owe my mom a lot of thank yous and appreciation. And
so who did you sell it to in those first days? Was this selling off social media, or how did you get your customers?
So I was still working at Red Bull, kept totally silent, and just worked on this by myself on the side. And got my product ready. I think my expertise is definitely in branding and content. And, I have amazing influencer friends and photographers and videographers, and they all band together. And we did this awesome launch photo shoot that totally different than anything the wine industry's seen. And I launched just on my own social media, posted 2 TikToks, both went pretty viral, a couple 100,000 views. And in a couple of weeks' time, I had sold out of that small batch quantity that I first made.
It's amazing. So you've got these fantastic names, Obsessed, Unwind. Oh my God. Were those your own names or did you crowdsource them? How did you come up with that?
So we always go to social media and kind of let our community input. I mean, there's amazing tools like the voting tool that can literally, I mean, you're consumers right there ready to participate. And so we always look to them, but the names really come from that moment where I was going, what is a varietal? And I realized that at least for me and my friends, they were going in and buying a bottle for a reason or occasion, not necessarily because they wanted a Zinfandel that night, right? And so what the names are meant to do is, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to my best friend's engagement party. I'm going to grab OMG. Or I'm having a chill night in and we're watching The Bachelor. Oh, Unwind works perfectly for that. So it's really focused on the occasion.
You know, your choice of Cabernet Sauvignon, once it was out in the world, did people start to say to you, Cab Sauv's not really my thing? How did you come up with the insight that maybe this wasn't the right variety?
That just, I think, came from time and my own education. And we're skipping forward a little bit, so we'll go back to that. But when it came time that I was relaunching Winey Baby from the Cab and the Chardonnay, and I was able to, I had, you know, these new partners, and we were kind of launching the product, you know, in retail, versus before it was just, you know, direct to consumer, California only, really small. I knew that what I wanted was the starting place in wine. It's like, where do you even begin? How do you know which varietal is the right varietal to start with? And so I learned that blends tend to be a bit more approachable and, you know, easily drinkable. And so I went, I don't know where to begin. I'm going to start with, this is my go-to red, my go-to white, my go-to rosé. Like that to me was the perfect, I like to call it our starter pack. And so that's what we relaunched with was 3 blends that were fun to drink, but still, you know, premium quality and delicious. And
now you're using the word we, and now you work with the McBride sisters. How did that happen?
So again, with my naivety, I sold out and knew like I need a path forward. I'm still working full time, you know, at Red Bull, and the options that were set, I just would take calls with any, you know, I'd LinkedIn stalk people, call them, you know, message. This is actually one of my favorite things. To this day, this happens. I didn't know what distributors were, and I didn't know that it was... illegal. You know, it wasn't, Target could just go, okay, whiny baby, I'm gonna, you know, right? I didn't know that that wasn't even legal, right? So I would message buyers and just like, hi, like you should take my wine, you know, whatever. And so then, you know, down the line when I was actually, you know, I had distributors and was in meetings with retailers, I would say, just so you know, if you look at your LinkedIn, you can unsend Instagram DMs, but you cannot unsend a LinkedIn message. So you definitely have a LinkedIn message from me. And thankfully, they found it endearing and refreshing and honest. And so I would talk to anybody that would talk to me. I'd ask for their advice. And the advice that I was given was you could bootstrap, sell, grow, sell, grow. I knew that in this industry, it'd take me 10 years to get on, if I was lucky, to get on a major, you know, store shelf if I went that route. Or you could do what a lot of young founders are doing, which is raise, excuse my language, a shit ton of money. And I knew that for
me— That's getting hard though. That's getting really hard to do that.
I think that people are realizing, right? They raise all this money, never become profitable. You know, it wasn't working. And so I knew for me, I could raise all the money in the world, but this industry is too complex. I wouldn't know how to properly spend. You can't crack in that same way. So what I kind of dreamt up was a strategic partnership. I went, there's all these big wine companies who have what I need, the infrastructure, the winemaking excellence, the distribution, and I have what they need, which is this demographic and community and innovation. What, can't we just work something out here? So I didn't know, you know, who my partners would be at the time. I just knew I needed them. And I'm a religious listener of How I Built This. And
that's great. Mm.
So good. All sorts of podcasts. And so, you know, I had listened to The Sister's Story and I was on a call with this gentleman. Again, I would just take these cold calls, anyone that would talk to me. Again, same advice, bootstrap, raise money. And I'm like, okay. And thankfully, at the beginning of the call, he said, you remind me of these women I worked with, you know, 20 years ago. And at the end of the call, I asked him, you know, who those women were. He said, the McBride sisters. I said, I was very familiar and would love to get in contact with them. Finally got a meeting with them and the rest is history. We entered into a strategic partnership and have been in this incubation sort of deal for the past 2 years and very forever grateful for them taking a risk on me. And I credit them a lot too. They've allowed the authenticity of the brand to remain where a lot of major companies, if they entered into a deal like this.
So for listeners who don't know, especially outside the United States, explain who the McBride sisters are.
The McBride sisters are, in my opinion, some of the most innovative and groundbreaking winemakers of our generation, but they are the largest Black-owned and the largest female-owned winery in the U.S. And they have a really incredible story. They're two sisters that didn't know each other growing up, found each other, they'd meet in wine country. And similar to myself, they saw a need for more representation and inclusivity in this industry to welcome in different types of people to drink wine.
That's a fantastic story. I mean, the whole thing is a fantastic story. Now, you've had your very innovative labels actually ripped off by other wine companies. Does that make you feel seen or is that really annoying?
You know, I think that there's a couple things you get used to. As a business owner, you just accept that and as a forward, not everybody's a forward-facing founder. I am. And in that, you just accept that you have criticism, good and bad. You accept that ideas are going to be taken, good and bad. I just know to my core that, like I said in the beginning, Whiny Baby isn't just a trendy label. Everything has been reimagined about it. And because of that, I'm just confident in the fact that you can't rip off Whiny Baby because it's one of a kind.
It's a really interesting point. Often people do rip off the, you know, the outside of it, but they don't understand what motivates it, so it doesn't work as well. I just want to go back a step back to the McBride sisters because I should have asked you, when you went into business with them, was it a joint venture? Did you give them equity? Do you retain all the ownership? How does it work?
Yep. So it was all through equity, and we are in a joint venture now.
Right. And how did that change your view of wine and the wine trade?
Oh my goodness. I mean, I am on a learning journey every single day. And again, I credit them to the fact that they also believe that the superpower of Winey Baby is the fact that I don't know how things should be done, so I can reimagine how they can be done. And they allowed and continue to allow me to do that. You'll notice that the three bottles are our rosé is slightly frizzante, but it's not a full sparkling. But all three bottles are in technically sparkling bottles, and the other two are completely still wines. And that was just because it was important to me that this is a starter pack. And I know that my consumer, you know, cares more about aesthetics, and I didn't know what wine is supposed to go in what bottles. And so I asked their winemaking team, hey, will it hurt the wine if it's in this bottle? And they're like, no. And so why can't I do it? Well, you can, but that's not really how things are done. And thankfully, the sisters have allowed me to go, no, it doesn't hurt the wine. Why not? And you know what's funny? I've never once been asked by a consumer, why are the still wines in sparkling bottles?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting point. There's a lot of people who think that the reason that rosé is so popular is just because the bottles are really interesting. You know, they're not the traditional bottles at all. You know, they look fantastic. So this reimagining really works. So how did the people at Red Bull react when you went, I'm off, I've started a wine brand?
You know, it's funny. I had a call 2 days ago with an old coworker from Red Bull, just catching up. And she had said, oh, you know, leadership here and there will always reference you and go, you know, we thought she was so, you know, stupid at the time. Like, look who's laughing now. You know?
Well, that's honest.
Yeah, right? So, you know, actually one of my favorite stories is I was driving the U-Haul from Gilroy. That's where I sourced that original wine, by myself back to LA to store it in the facility. And we were delayed in bottling, so we got back much later than expected. And, you know, I was not gonna leave my U-Haul overnight on a random street in LA and risk this product that was my whole life, you know, getting stolen or something happening. And so Red Bull is gated, and it was pretty common for, you know, employees to, if they were traveling, to park their car there overnight or whatever. And so, one of my coworkers said, who I confided in at the time that knew I was, you know, doing this, she goes, why don't you park it overnight at Red Bull? Like, they'll never know. And if anyone asks.
Yeah, no, because there's no cameras anywhere. Just park it and see what happens.
So it's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I go in, and I didn't realize there's a commercial entrance and a regular car entrance. So I tried to put the U-Haul through the regular car entrance and broke the gate. And I go to work that Monday, and everyone's like, who broke the gate? So weird. I don't know.
Did you say, no idea? Or did you go, it's me?
No, I said, no idea. I was like, I have no clue. Of course, they all know now and think it's funny. But I think that's my time at Red Bull. I've been in a rush my whole life to get to the next thing. I dropped out of college because I was like, I'm ready to go. And if there's one thing I could tell younger me, or even young, you know, entrepreneurs who feel that same way, the corporate experience that I've had is invaluable, and I probably could have used 10 more years of it.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because I've seen this over and over with people who go out and start their own businesses, and too often they don't have any idea of what processes are. I mean, when you've been through the corporate rat race, the thing that you want to get away from is those processes and stuff like that, because often it's bureaucracy. But it's such an invaluable experience.
100%.
And also it teaches you to think much bigger as well.
If I hadn't had bad bosses, I wouldn't know how to be a good boss, right? So I think 100% and exactly what you're saying. I was able to see the areas that made Red Bull so great, and then I was able to see the processes that made it more difficult to get things done. And that's why I think young founders and entrepreneurs are eager to get big. And I always try to remind myself, while we're small and continue to remain small, the efficiency we have is, you know, invaluable.
That is super smart. And while I'm ranting, I mean, this is your interview, not mine, but many people in the wine trade don't get management training, you know, don't realize how important it is. And it's incredibly important. as is learning to use spreadsheets.
Whenever I meet executives, and it's not just, I mean, there's so many incredible people in the wine industry that have been in it for so long, but I always get really excited when I hear they've come from other, you know, industries and other companies, because I just think that that mindset being brought to the wine industry is really what we need.
Rightio, let's talk numbers and money. So how much did it cost you and where'd you get the money from? Was it your life savings or did your mum stump up the
well,
money?
Well, I was 22, so my life savings was like in the negatives. But no, I believe in being so transparent when it comes to money where I can, you know, obviously when it's partners are involved and whatnot. But when it's my personal money, I think it's so important because you go on TikTok now and you see these, you know, young founders and these success stories and you're going like, how in the world, where did they get this money? And so I was very fortunate that my college was paid for by my family, but in kind of the money was set aside in a certain fund or whatever. And so when I dropped out, I had different ambitions at the time, but always tons of ambitions. And so I said, I'm dropping out, I'm moving to LA, and I'd like to have the remainder of my college money to get me started. And thankfully, my family said no. And
did they say something? You're not going to be an actress, are you, Jess?
Yeah, no. They're like, absolutely not. And so then I tried again throughout the years, you know, different ambitions at the time, not necessarily companies, but, you know, who knows? And they continued to say no. Again, thankfully. And, you know, it wasn't a lot of money. We're talking like $15,000-$20,000. And so, you know, definitely substantial enough to get me started.
It is substantial when you're 22.
Definitely. But I like to say, I mean, while I was so fortunate that I was able to get that, you know, I would have found a way to raise it. I mean, where there's a will, there is a way. And so I was also fortunate that it was an amount that was small enough that made me be fairly disciplined, right? I went to go get my, you know, do my branding. I had all these amazing contacts from Red Bull branding agencies and whatever. And one of the first agencies I went to, very well known, has designed, you know, a lot of these prebiotic sodas, you know, stuff like that. They quoted me like $75,000. And I was like, yeah, that's not happening. And I found this girl on Instagram. She did all my branding and she, to this day, does all of Whiny Baby's graphics. I will hold on to her forever. But it's people like that. She, you know, did it. It's such a low cost. And I tell her every single day, as I grow, you know, you taking a risk and doing these things for me. I mean, she's obviously gets paid, but I hope that I can grow that over time. Like she deserves the 75K, right? For taking a risk. She certainly did it for way, not even close to that. But I believe that holding on to people and having them grow with you is so important. But back to the money itself, I, you know, had the idea when I was 22. I think it's important to always note, people are always like, I have all these ideas. Like the only difference between me and them is I just actually did it and was delusional enough to believe I could do it. That's the only difference. And I had a good year where I Googled how to do it and was like, okay, like this is, I can't figure, you know, life gets in the way. And so there, it was a whole year where I had the idea when I was bored, maybe I'd look into it and I didn't really do anything. And I had, an unfortunate life event, a family member had passed away. And that was the pivotal moment where I went, life is short. You know, at 22, you don't have a ton of life perspective. So it's these things that shift your thinking. And I went, I really need to go for this. Put together a formal business plan and pitch deck, shared it with my family. And they finally said, you know, okay, this is the thing we'll, you know, I have to pay them back for that. But that was the thing that they said yes to.
what year was this?
2023.
Okay. So,
excuse me. I was 22. 2020 was the pandemic. 2021 was when I really started moving forward. And then 2023, I had the partnership with the
sisters. So can I ask you, is this how you earn your living now? Are you making enough money to pay yourself a salary or is it still on that upward trajectory?
So I am fortunate that in my partnership, I'm in a 3-year incubation deal with the sisters. We are in year 2 of that. And in that, I insured a salary.
Great. Okay. All right. So let's talk about Gordon Ramsay. Woo. How on earth did you get involved? Tell the story from the beginning.
So I have been asked to be on a couple different shows, things like Shark Tank and stuff like that. The difference is, a lot of people don't know this. I'm sure you know this. Just to go on a show like that, you have to give up equity, which I did not want to do.
I did not know that. I absolutely did not know that. Well, that is, I'm good for you.
So just to get airtime, while that is incredible, I mean, you also have to think, it's 2 minutes if you're lucky of airtime, and you're giving up equity, and you give up the equity without even, you may not even get a deal out of it, right? And so I just knew that that wasn't something me or my partners were interested in. Yeah. On Whiny Baby, I think you noted something about our phone number. So we've got our interactive phone number on all our bottles, which super fun. I mean, you wouldn't believe the voicemails I get. I'm sure.
I want to hear about the voicemails. That's one of the things I've tipped to ask you, but we'll talk about Gordon Ramsay first, and then we'll come back to the voicemail.
So, that is meant to be another form of consumer interaction, and it's actually become a form of trade and industry interaction as well, which is funny. And I got a voicemail from a casting director that said, "Hi, you know, we're casting for season 2 of Gordon Ramsay's Food Stars. We think you'd be a great fit, yada, yada, yada." So I kind of went through the initial, you know, just kind of hearing them out and what it was all about. I brought it to my partners and I said, "I'm not doing this." I mean, reality TV is like, it's meant to be, at the end of the day, entertainment. So they're going to want to make, you know, a mockery of me. Also, they're putting you in situations where you lose your temper and, you know, there's a lot at risk. And I said to my partners, I was like, "I'm not putting myself on a reality TV show." And they were like, "Yeah, you absolutely are." Thankfully, they pushed me a little bit because it was, you know, one of the greatest things I've ever done.
Okay, so actually, you know, it is a big risk. There is a woman in the wine trade who used to be a producer for the Jerry Springer show, and she told me one night for dinner, so she had to get the people, she had to get them on the show.
I would love to know her name, because I just watched the Netflix documentary two days ago.
We'll talk about it when the interview's over, because it's a hilarious story. But she told me the whole bit about how she, you know, if people weren't screaming enough, you know, in the interval, it was her job to sort of wind them up.
No, they make you do psychology tests before. And I think it's to figure out what pushes your buttons.
Yeah, I think so too. All right. So you get this opportunity and you go on the show. Tell us about it.
I mean, I think I'm still processing it. I went and I filmed in February of this year. So it really wasn't, most people go on shows like that and it won't air for a year. I don't know why it was, but we had a really, like, all the producers were saying it was one of the quickest turnarounds. We filmed from February to the end of April. So you're gone for like 2-3 months. You have limited computer and phone access. Again, a lot of young founders could never be away from their computer that long, you know? So another benefit to my partners, right? Obviously I still worked while I was there, but it was far, you know, I wasn't able to be, you know, on how I am normally day to day. But it was absolute chaos. The best way to describe it is it's a blend of Shark Tank and The Apprentice and kind of The Voice. So we didn't know about Lisa Vanderpump's involvement when we were cast. We found out the day that we started filming that she was involved. And you walked in and you had to pitch to Gordon and Lisa, and you'd either get on one of their teams or you would get sent home. And we filmed in London, and when we got there, we're like, "They're not flying people back to they didn't fly everyone here just to send them home." Oh, they definitely did. And so you would either get on a team or not get on a team. All food, beverage adjacent entrepreneurs of all different kinds. And you would get on a team, and then every challenge or competition was something business related. So profitability, marketing, stuff like that. And till you get to the end, and if you made it to the finale, like I did, you had to basically give like a 10-minute TED talk to a room full of industry experts. And you would talk about how you want to expand your business and kind of, you know, why you deserve to win. And then you win or lose.
Did they give you any coaching, or was it all just on you?
So you would get on camera time with Gordon and Lisa where there was, you know, elements of coaching. I would say what made me successful on the show was having an entertainment background, I knew production to some degree. My speaking, and I would say like 40% of the show was being able to write a pitch and a presentation and literally get on stage and do it. We had to do that 4 or 5 times. I mean, we pitched to the executives of Mars in the Mars headquarters, and you had maybe 2 hours to write and prepare that pitch. So if you were not a good public speaker, you really couldn't go far in the competition. And then lastly, I would say it actually goes back to what we were talking about, corporate experience. Mm-hmm. I think because I had that, a lot of these entrepreneurs don't have corporate experience. And because of that, I knew how to handle, you know, gracefully and professionally intense and argumentative environments and disagreements in a way that's professional. And I knew how to manage a team. A lot of it was, how do you manage a team without being, you know, the star or this like overbearing leader, which if you haven't had corporate experience, you may not know how to do.
What was Mars like? Was it full of Mars bars? Or was it just a cold corporate office?
No, we walked in and there was the M&M characters in like suits. It was fabulous. Yeah, we had to pitch a new candy bar. I mean, it was the greatest experience of my life. And honestly, it was every entrepreneur's dream, because you would go in, you would have to create a product, and they had teams of people that overnight would bring your product to life. So you'd sit down.
Wow.
Oh yeah, you'd ideate. Then you walk into a packaging room and you'd pick out your packaging. And then you would sit with a graphic designer and graphic design, and overnight they would develop your product. I mean, it was like a dream.
I'm so envious. I used to follow all the animal scientists from Mars on social media, because they've got 88 scientists who create pet food. And they're always asking each other deep questions about pets.
I love that.
Yeah, that's right. Apparently the big question is, why do cats like tuna? Because tuna's a deep water fish, and so cats, from an evolutionary point of view, could never have eaten it. So, but they really like it. I don't know, anyway, that's got nothing to do with this interview. But I'd like to go out to the Mars.
I love that. It's funny though, because it does go back to like what we're talking about. One of the things that I also, again, back to Red Bull, I'm like, I should be drinking a Red Bull, not a Celsius. I was like a sponsored Red Bull post, but was that they allowed you, I forget what it was. I think you had like $500. You had allotted a small amount of money and time that they allowed you to invest in your own personal passions. And that is something that I've taken with me and applied to people that work, you know, with and for Whiny Baby. Of if the people you work with and for are, and that work for you are personally fulfilled and feel that this job can help them express those personal passions, you've got loyal.
How big is your team?
So it's interesting. It's kind of divided. So majority is through the McBride sisters. So, right, their sales team is my sales team. They're, you know, whatever. But what I have two fully dedicated Whiny Baby people that operate kind of separately. So everything that is, you know, consumer marketing, branding, content type focused is just directly like me and the designer, and then someone who kind of heads up content, community efforts, events, things like that.
Now, let's go back to Gordon Ramsay, because you won $250,000. What was that like? And what did you do with the money?
It was obviously one of the most fun moments of my life. You know, I mean this when I say this, because I say this often. Of course, it was exciting for myself personally. It really felt like a win for the wine industry on such a public platform of all different kinds of, on a food show. The whole time I was going, they're going to make someone from Gordon's team win. And like, also, I don't cook. I said that throughout the whole show. I'm like, I do not cook. They're not going to make me the food star. And so the fact that it was wine and a Gen Zer in wine felt like a big win for the wine industry. The money, so exciting. Obviously, you've got to pay taxes on that. You know, it's actually a fun fact. In the UK, prize money is not taxed. So I was
Is it taxed in America?
Yeah. Competition.
Oh, that sucks. So, because where I live in Germany, I'm opposite a newsagent, and they're always advertising a lottery, and like it went up to, I think, to 17 million euros last week. And it's not taxed. If you win it, it's yours.
So we tried, I was going, we're filming this in London. And the production company was, Studio Ramsay is based in London. Amazing people. Hopefully going to continue to work with them, on stuff in the future. Very passionate about wine entertainment and wine television and things like that. But that's a whole other rant. Anyways, the prize money, amazing. Some of it, I was able to start paying my mom back just a little bit. And then the rest, of course, goes, to my partners and back into the business. But from the time that I got back from filming the show, we were able to secure a deal with a retail partner that expanded us. When I went onto the show, Whiny Baby was in 4 states, and today we're in 27 states.
My God, that is such an amazing story. I could just imagine that first meeting. So how'd you go? Well, I got $250,000.
It was Mom. So, I mean, and to be able, it's not a secret. I'm pretty sure I can share it. Going into 2025, we're going to be in Meijer, which is a huge account in the Midwest. In California, we are going to be in some Whole Foods, which is really a full circle moment as well, because that was the store that I had the idea in. So,
oh my God. I'm not surprised that you won, actually, because Gordon Ramsay has launched a lot of wine brands through, really good choice of house wine and things like that. I think the business is actually quite wine knowledgeable. So they probably looked at it and went, this is what the wine industry really needs.
So you'll have to go back and try to find the episode in the UK. I don't think you can watch it on Hulu, so you may have to get creative. But there's an episode that is a wine episode, because Lisa Vanderpump and Gordon, like you said, both have their own wines. And in the episode, we had to develop a label for them and film a wine commercial for them.
Oh.
And so, of course, each challenge, there's a different leader on the teams. So, of course, I had to lead that challenge, and was thinking the entire time, if I lose this challenge, my career's is over in wine. Also worth noting, and actually another fascinating conversation, there was another wine industry professional on the show, and he produces more quote unquote natural small batch wine and owns an urban winery in Philadelphia. So we kind of like to say it was like, although I'm not, I do in that sense kind of represent more the traditional wine scene versus the small batch, quote unquote, I like to say natural wine scenes that we're seeing pop up. So
obviously that is a huge thing to happen. Did that bring people knocking on your door? Did more people start leaving telephone messages? Tell me about that.
Absolutely. It's opened up so much exciting opportunity. Obviously, first and foremost, having more of a national, presence for Whiny Baby is the biggest win. And just seeing people from all over, have interest in it. Our base was, California heavy, just because that's where I am. And so now it having it be more represented across the U.S. But like I hinted at earlier, I've gotten a lot of opportunity in the entertainment space because of it. And so nothing that I can officially share yet, but stay tuned for hopefully some exciting myself and Whiny Baby entertainment content.
I won't be able to sleep tonight. You've now wrecked my, I'll be lying awake thinking, what's going to happen?
Because even some of, you look at wine in television shows and movies, and even that needs a refresh, right? Of how wine's represented in media.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's done a lot of damage actually is how many middle-aged women are seen with, huge glasses, and they're drinking because they need to get drunk. I think that's done horrifying damage to wine actually. So anything you can do about that, we'd all be grateful.
I hate to even have it come out of my mouth, but yeah, the cougar juice representation is, I couldn't agree more.
Okay, so tell me about your own wine journey. So you started out not knowing anything and then Googling Cabernet Sauvignon. And where are you now? What's your view of wine?
So even though I have to catch myself, honestly, daily, because I own a wine brand. Of course, I should be an expert in wine. No, I know how to partner with experts in wine. And it's funny, the McBride sisters, of course, I naturally, continue to learn about wine, but I try to do it as a consumer and not as someone in the industry. And so the little things like I found myself as a business owner, my own social life, right, was kind of declining. I wasn't hosting as much. And I went, oh my gosh, when I stop hosting, when I stop going out to a wine bar and having drinks myself, I'm losing the whole point. I'm losing touch. And so as a business owner, you don't have a lot of free time to do those things, but I have to prioritize it. And so in that, I started noticing, okay, I'm having these dinner parties. Of course, Winey Baby's there, but I want people to bring different wine. I want to see what they are drinking, you know, not out of, you know, oh, of course they're going to bring Winey Baby. And, all my friends were bringing orange wines. Oh. And I was, you know, started developing an orange wine and didn't know that skin contact, of course, meant, you know, the grapes. I thought it meant the winemaker was hands-on. No, like being unashamed of what I don't know, because that's, if I didn't know that, our consumers didn't know it. And so we've been developing our own orange wine, and that came from me, myself being a consumer and seeing, okay, this is what my friends are drinking, and hearing from them, well, why do you like this? Why are you drinking it? And hearing from them, people think that orange wine has oranges in it. Like they do. And so it's like, that sounds ridiculous to people in the industry, but to the consumers, right? They don't know. And so, that's how I continue my wine journey. I have a personal passion for it. So of course I've, started my W sets. I just finished W set 2 and I'm going to do W set 3 this year. But for me, the future of Winey Baby and the future for the wine industry and innovation lies in education. How do we make that education of wine, entertaining, fun to consume and easy to understand. And
well, this is the question that everybody is absolutely obsessed with. And the issue is always that when you get beyond a certain point, wine is just really, really complicated. Like there's thousands of different varieties. There's thousands of different appellations. There's blah, 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 blah. So what are your thoughts? How do you go from here's a wine that everybody likes to stepping into the category?
Yeah. It's something that I'm trying to figure out as we speak. Like I said in the beginning, right, we launched again with these blends. And in starting with that, I have already started going on these kind of college town tours where I have these tastemaker dinner parties. And I'm not joking when I say I get told I didn't think I liked wine until I tried Winey Baby, right? They're just approachable and fun and easy to drink. And for maybe people who have been in the industry or are farther along on their wine journey, they may feel, you know, a little on the sweeter side, but compared to what a lot of these entry point wines are, they're, you know, balanced with acidity and juicy and just fun. And the second thing I hear all the time is, I definitely didn't think I liked red wine until I tried this. Wow. And so where I see the future going is even in our own, we're doing a bunch of classroom series coming up with a retail partner this year, which I'm really excited about. But we get to taste them through the wines and then we get to go, oh, you liked the red. Well, the red is predominantly Zinfandel, which is why you're getting those cherries and berries. So the next time you go out there and you are ready to dip your toes into a specific varietal, maybe start there, you know? So I think it's like the first hurdle is to get them to just try it and like it. And then the next hurdle we're able to conquer is curiosity and dipping their toes into the water of varietals and appellations. And
yeah, it's so interesting you say that, because when you talk to, you know, all the big companies have got analysts inside them. They don't publicize it, but they do. And if you say to them, how do you get people, you know, moving up the ladder? They say, you don't. The most important thing is for people to think of themselves as somebody who drinks wine. And then what they do is they drink wine according to the occasion. So if they're a lawyer and they go to a lawyer's dinner, they're going to drink posh wine. And if they're at home watching television, they're going to drink something else. And it doesn't matter. What's most important is that they think of themselves as being a wine drinker.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And I think we all, if we're being honest, like, I'm still like guilty of that too. It's like, do I know that this is a nice bottle of wine, or am I just being told that and have the perception? And if I'm being honest with Winey Baby, that's something I'm exploring right now. I think there's no reason why brands can't develop and grow and change over time. And our packaging is fun. And but I've had to ask myself, is our packaging excluding older generations or people, you know, more advanced?
Does it matter though? I mean, if you've got an audience that really loves what you're doing, does it matter if a bunch of other people go, that's not for me?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I'm I want Whiny Baby to be where people's wine journey begins, no matter their age. And I think where packaging really does matter and is my biggest hurdle is, unfortunately, approachable, fun packaging has equated in consumers' mind as not premium quality wine.
Or as natural wine.
Right? So, they just see a fun label and it's like, oh, it must be shitty wine. Unfortunately, that's the perception. And again, people all the time will try Whiny Baby and go, oh, I was surprised that it's good wine.
That's interesting.
Which
that's
is unfortunate really... because, you know, the label has nothing to do with what's inside.
That is so interesting. Before I forget, I want to find out, what are some of these messages you get when people call a phone number?
So most of our marketing taglines are representative of my own personal life and my friends. So one of them is, call your ex, call us. Because I think people have a drink or two. You get texty fingers and you never know. You wake up the next morning, you're like, oh gosh, I was feeling a little too good about myself there. But no, we just try to have fun with it. And I think beyond the funny messages and one of my favorite ones was someone texted the bottle cap question. And the question was one of our more risque ones, which is the craziest place you've done the deed. And they said, I opened this, my grandparents opened this at our Rosh Hashanah dinner. And they were like, they said it ended up being like super funny, but they texted us that. And so my favorites are, of course, when people call and text and tell us about their experience with Whiny Baby. But what's funny from an industry perspective is, let out like just a sigh of like, half of our job is working with distributors. It's something that you just don't know. And it's something you're always trying to get better about. But when we expanded into all these new states after the show, I had no idea that a lot of times I wouldn't know when the product actually landed on the shelf. Yeah. I'd know, okay, we're going to be in Connecticut in a Total Wine, but you don't know when it's there unless I drive to a store. Sometimes that's my only way of knowing. So instead of being like, every hurdle we try to lean into and try to not be embarrassed to share with our community. And so I went on social media and I said, here's all the new states where we're supposed to be in, hopefully this month. I don't know. I don't want to waste your time. I mean, it breaks my heart when consumers go out and it's not there. And, I feel like I wasted their time. So, saying, look, I need your help. I don't know if it's out there. I don't want to waste your time. It could or it couldn't. And sure enough, our community has become like our little soldiers and would text me pictures like, it landed in Florida, Boca Raton, like it's here. And then I could immediately go on social media and say, okay, confirmation, it is in Boca Raton, So
that's
really where it's been fun to lean into the challenges.
So let's talk a bit about the cohort. There is a lot of evidence that people are just drinking less alcohol for health reasons or because they want to stay sharp or they don't want to be seen on social media in compromising positions and stuff. What's your view? Is this overstated or is this something that is for real?
It's hard. I obviously this is the hot topic, what everyone's talking about and, what the new, cancer warning labels and everything like that, right? I try to not make assumptions based on my bubble. What me and my friends do and how we consume is not, representative of the rest of the nation or the world for that matter. What I do know to be true is alcohol is still present. I was talking about it with someone yesterday where we were saying, you still go on a golf course. And even if someone's not an avid drinker, if my boyfriend, when he's playing golf, like he's not an avid drinker, but yeah, he's going to have, a beer with his friends. And so there's certain situations. I saw it the other night, like it's dry January, right? But I went to a book club last week and everyone was having a glass of wine, So I think that there's certain occasions where you're not going to go to a holiday dinner and there's not alcohol. You're not going to go to a birthday. So again, I always try to go back to the occasions. And then what I really believe to be true is there is a shift in how young people are drinking. And so I think, you know, the whole, you know, going to college and tequila shots, that never resonated with me. But we are seeing a rise in dinner party culture. Like, that is true. And I think, you know, there is a Gen Z is the loneliest generation. They are looking for community. And so what's not going away is the fact that wine and food and a shared table are the greatest conduits of connection. And so while it may be naive, while, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, I do believe those things to be true.
Half of the North American wine industry listening to this podcast is cheering right now. You can't hear it, but they're going, yay!
I live in the world of social media. And to me, these young CPG founders are everywhere. But I went to a major retailer summit for the first time a couple months ago. And I looked around, it was a supplier summit for a major retailer. I was definitely the youngest person in the room. And I reminded myself, just because online it looks like we're seeing a bunch of young people in the space, I think the industry, like corporate industry, you know, for real is not, I would ask all these companies how many Gen Zers they're employing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And I think that's it, social media is not representative of.
No, but I think you're touching on something really important. I mean, I spend a lot of my life at conferences and trade fairs, and unfortunately everybody talks to the same people. You know, I'm guilty of that. I do a lot of speaking on the circuit and stuff. And what, okay, so what happens is you go and give a speech at a conference and the audience rates you, right? It's like the Hunger Games. So if you come up at the top, you get invited somewhere else. And then what happens is they go, well, she's spoken at three conferences, so she must be good. And so what happens is it all gets locked. Yeah, it gets locked up. And you know, the conferences urgently need somebody like you to come and talk. But, you know, the conference organizers are busy ticking boxes, I think.
Right.
So where do you see the big opportunities?
Like I said, I think, again, back to Red Bull, I got to see firsthand that they were trying to speak to the same consumers the wine industry is too, right? They were trying to solve all the problems. And I'd be sitting in a boardroom, the youngest person, going, no offense, but why are you guys not, why are you asking each other how you solve this and not asking the community themselves? And so I would say, you know, the wine industry is still on social media, right? Has a long way to go. But rather than thinking about it of, oh, are they making cool content? Are they, forget that. Is this a real community you're interacting with? Don't go and hire, you know, these big branding agencies to make these flashy, cool campaigns. That's all great and all. Gen Z sees right through it. They just want to be an active member and participant in what you're doing. And honestly, I think that would solve a lot of problems.
So what's next for you? Are you going to just continue the range? Are you going to do premium wine, or are you going to start doing RTDs or move into a different category of alcohol?
What don't I want to do? Well, I can say that I'm in some very exciting conversations with other industry leaders that would open up incredible doors for Winey Baby. So hopefully there's exciting announcements to come. So I will leave that there. And maybe we'll be chatting again soon.
Oh, you're teasing me. You're teasing me.
Where we can talk all about that. I am passionate about education and entertainment, so you can see lots more to come with that. I definitely,
and of course, you've got a reality television show that somebody's going to put you on.
Exactly. I am passionate about RTDs, and definitely want to enter into that space. And I'm super passionate about real life experiences. I can't wait. I you know, it's funny. I think an undertapped market is trains. In the US, they're not nearly as popular, but I think they're going to be more on the rise. And, you know, when I was going to school in San Diego, we'd go on the train and go to LA and see a concert in LA. And I just am fascinated with, like, you know, the golf scene, stadiums, concerts, book clubs, just any occasion, right? And so I just can't wait to get my hands on all these different areas that people are consuming wine. But like I said, really passionate about education and excited to grow and take the Winey Baby community on their wine journey.
I see a sticker book in your future.
Wait, how did you know? That's definitely, you know exactly what I'm doing. Definitely.
All right. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation and so inspirational. So on that note, thank you so much, Jess.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.